Questions to raise at a strategy review. In the strategy review, you'll be going over the same critical issues that you developed in building the strategic plan, Chapter 7. But in this expanded group, you'll be getting a fresh diversity of viewpoints. The CFO's staff will be looking at the plan's financial realism. The human resources people will be questioning the implications for leadership development, and so on. In the end, the discussion must answer the key questions. Is the plan plausible and realistic? Is it internally consistent? Does it match the critical issues and the assumptions? Are people committed to it? You'll also be raising new questions and sharpening old ones to new levels of specificity. For example, 1. How well-versed is each business unit team about the competition? 2. How strong is the organizational capability to execute the strategy? 3. Is the plan scattered or sharply focused? 4. Are we choosing the right ideas? 5. Are the linkages with people and operations clear? How well-versed is each business unit team about the competition? It goes without saying that the strategy review needs to analyze the competition. Far too often, however, competitor analysis is focused only on past history, industry dynamics, cost structure, market share, brand differentiation, and power in distribution channels. What really counts is not pages of data about what the competition has done in the past, but real-time reporting on what they're up to and likely to do next. 1. What are our competitors planning to do to serve their customer segments and prevent us from serving them? 2. How good are their sales forces? 3. What are our competitors doing to increase market share? 4. How will they respond to our product offerings? 5. What do we know about the background of our competition's leadership? If they are from marketing, they may be most likely to respond with new marketing programs. If they are from production, they may try to enhance quality. 6. What do we know about the leader of a fierce competitor and his motivations, and what does that mean for us? If a competitor has heavy incentives to gain market share, his motivation could well be to prevent us from moving into that segment, even if his profitability goes down. He may not sustain falling profitability for long, but will it block our entry? 7. What acquisitions will our key competitors make that will affect us? 8. Could a competitor form an alliance and attack our segment? For example, Sun Microsystems has to carefully evaluate Dell's recent alliance with EMC to accelerate its penetration in the server and storage markets. 9. What new people have competitors added that could alter the competitive landscape? Ford and Chrysler, for example, should be taking a very careful look at what the appointment of Bob Lutz as vice chairman of General Motors signifies. GM has been making steady progress in reducing costs since Rick Wagoner became president and then CEO. Now, by reaching out and bringing in the car world's best product developer, GM has taken a big step in its quest to regain market share. Lutz is not only the flamboyant car guy with a great understanding of consumer needs, but a cost-conscious team player. His track record at both Ford and Chrysler in designing and developing new products with shorter development cycles is unparalleled. An effective analysis of the competition at every auto company will demand the team's intellectually honest view of what the addition of Lutz means for each company individually, and the industry as a whole. How strong is the organizational capability to execute the strategy? Here's where a tight and consistent linkage between strategy and people processes becomes critical. For example, a leading software services company has grown rapidly over the past 3 years. increasing its contracts from $4 billion in 1999 to $12 billion in 2001. Its sales staff has, for the most part, sold services to the information technology managers of Fortune 1000 companies. Its individual contracts with these companies have been in the $500 million range. To maintain its rate of growth, the company now needs to become dominant at Fortune 50 companies and increase the size of its contracts to the $2 billion range. Reaching this next level will require selling to CEOs and CFOs and stressing the dollars and cents benefits of the services to the client companies. The new game needs multifunctional teams that can create value propositions that link the services sold with the customer's financial results. This kind of selling can take as long as a year before a contract is closed, and the new team needs to have a better than 50% win ratio, up from the previous standard of 1 in 3. Executing the new strategy requires salespeople with the mental capacity to visualize the total needs of the Fortune 50 customer. Questions that need to be asked about organizational capability in situations like this include, do we have the sales force and sales engineers to win in the new market segments, or are they yesterday's people? The answer requires good input from the people process, where the new organizational structure, the leaders' capabilities, and criteria for judging them in the entry phase of this strategy should be discussed in depth. Do we know the technology and have a roadmap of how it will change over time? Do we have a cost structure that will allow us to compete profitably? Is the plan scattered or sharply focused? As businesses pursue growth by expanding their offerings, they often end up trying to provide more goods and services than they can handle comfortably. General Motors, Procter & Gamble, and many others have fallen victim to this overreaching. After 2 decades of unfocused growth, Unilever ended up with about 1,600 brands. In 2001, it confronted the problem head-on, reducing its brands to some 400. The results have already shown up in higher margins and revenue growth. Questions to ask. Is the plan too ambitious? What are our priorities to avoid fragmentation of effort? Is our leadership team taking on too many market segments simultaneously? Will it dilute our focus on our original market segment to the extent that we could lose the golden goose that is to fund the new segments? Are we choosing the right ideas? Many people strategize themselves into the wrong businesses. No matter how well you execute, the risk of failure increases markedly when the ideas you develop don't fit with your existing capabilities or force you to acquire those capabilities at too high a cost. For example, a large $6 billion industrial company with high margins used a network of small distributors to sell its product to customers. In a quest for growth, the company bought many of these distributors in order to build a retail chain. It brought in one of its own executives from Europe to run it, and the entrepreneurs who founded the distributors left. Going into retail was the wrong idea for this company. It had no expertise in retail, didn't understand how to make money in a low-margin business requiring significant logistical expertise, and was not prepared to spend the money necessary to build the capabilities needed to manage a completely different type of business. As a result, the company started to lose money and the stock price went down by a third. How do you make the right choices? You can get a good idea from how specific, clear, and robust the ideas are. Then you need a lot of dialogue to make sure that even the ideas that sound good make sense. You start by asking 4 basic questions about each one. Is this idea consistent with the realities of the marketplace? Does it mesh with our organization's capabilities? Are we pursuing more ideas than we can handle? Will the idea make money? You get the answers from robust dialogue among the business leaders with help from the planning staff. Then together, you can make a decision about which ideas to pursue.
For example, let's assume a business leader wants to enter a new market segment, but he doesn't have the right product. You want to know what is in this product segment and what's the growth rate of the segments within it. In addition to evaluating the idea, you've got to visualize how it's going to be adapted in your own environment. You don't want to get into a business where historically you haven't done very well. People do it all the time. Their thinking is, we haven't been in this business, but we've been in one that looks something like it, and we think we can assimilate the right capabilities to do it. That kind of thinking raises the risk level considerably. During my Allied Signal years, someone came to me and said, we just kind of, by accident, developed a new flat screen in one of our laboratories, and we want to get into the flat screen business. I looked at the technology, and it seemed to do what they said it would. So I said, that's wonderful, but we don't have any core technology in manufacturing flat screens. You tell me we can make it, but we don't have any history of making it. We may not even have a culture to deal with it in the right way. Some big players out there have the expertise. How likely is it that we're going to be able to outcompete them over time? In the end, and after a troublesome start, we licensed the technology to a company that had the manufacturing experience to deal with it. In other words, you have to not only evaluate the idea, but try to anticipate how it's going to fit into your environment. A good idea for a product or service may work at a company like the one that licensed the flat screen, but not at a company like Allied Signal or Honeywell. Good ideas aren't the same for everybody. Another thing to watch out for is taking on too many projects. Let's say that in the course of reviewing strategic plans for a month across the whole company, four wonderful new ideas surface among the many put forth. In terms of the work that needs to be done, they will all take 5 to 7 years to mature. A lot of people will just go ahead and take on all four ideas, but the programs all throw off big losses to begin with, because that's the nature of things, and then people start to feed them less heartily so that they can reduce the cost of the launches. That extends the time where they can become mature. When you see four new ideas like this, you have to say, look, our company isn't big enough to afford all of these. We're going to have to pick the two best ones and run with them. We can take the losses on them, but we're going to have to make some decisions about the other two. Maybe they'll be gone by the time we get to them, so maybe we should license them now. But we're not going to start four and then starve them and get nothing out of any of them. But in company after company, the appetite is much bigger than the ability to digest, and wrong decisions get made. Too much is taken on that doesn't come to fruition. The strategy review helps to further articulate the direction of the business. It provides the basis for allocating capital to things that have an attractive future and reducing capital to things that are less attractive.
Are the linkages with people and operations clear? Achieving everything we've talked about so far depends on linking the strategy process to the people and operations processes well. The more you and your people know about all three, the better judgments and trade-offs you can make about how well your strategy meshes with your capabilities, and whether it has a reasonable chance of being profitable. The linkage between strategy and operations becomes totally transparent when the first few pages of the operating plan, see Chapter 9, describe the new strategic direction, the resources required, and the programs to be executed quarter by quarter in the next year. The auto manufacturer supplier we discussed in Chapter 7 had executed a strategy that moved it from a break-even commodity business to the supplier of choice by the top 10 industrial customers around the world. It now wants to move to the next level by servicing new customers in adjacent segments. In the strategy review, the kind of questions about linkage to people and operations should include: the strategy of a business unit clearly lays out how it will reach a new set of customers and ways to get the product qualified in the new segment. If a new organizational structure is required, what new sales management skills will be needed? Are financial resources assigned in the next year's budget to build whatever is required to launch entry into the new segment? What are the programs for each quarter? How will the programs be funded quarter by quarter? Will the need for quarterly profits squeeze out these programs? Superior leaders make the right trade-offs between the short and long terms. Or suppose you want to go to the next level by moving into an adjacent segment. How do you get into the potential customers' doors? And how do you get their people to qualify the new product? That is, make sure it meets their specifications and needs. Each of these is both a people and an operations issue, raising such questions as: do you have the right kinds and numbers of people to do these things? Have you allotted enough lead time for the required actions?
A good strategic plan has to be translatable into the operating plan. Not all in 1 year, but it has to have an action quotient to it. Sometimes you go into these two processes and they make you think you're in two different companies. You review the strategic plan and you don't recognize any aspect of it when you review the operating plan, and vice versa. For an operating review, I like to quickly review the strategic plan to see that the link has been established. I want the first 3 pages of the document to be a summary of the strategic plan. The agreed-upon components of the strategic plan must have a seamless transition into the operating plan. Suppose in the strategic plan we determine that we are going to spend money to launch a new product that will complement our existing products, and we determine what its cost will be, the level of success we expect it to have, and that it will be tested with customers. In the operating plan, we need to make sure that it has an R&D plan of action that is funded at a level to carry out the strategic goal. Do your strategic assumptions mesh with your internal yardsticks? You have to define what you do and don't want to invest in, and the strategy compilations have to agree with those judgments. Internal indicators would include businesses you want to be in, businesses you don't want to be in, businesses you want to invest in, and businesses you want to harvest. Suppose somebody comes to you with a plan for growing his business revenue at 15% a year. He's a good leader, one who has always made his commitments. But you've noted that his market segment is growing at 3% a year. How is he going to achieve 15% growth, and at what cost? Is achieving a bigger share of this slow growth market worth the investment you'll have to make in product development, marketing, acquisitions, or whatever it is that will supposedly drive this growth? Maybe you can put the capital to better use. Or suppose somebody comes to you and says the business should go ahead and pursue these 4 good ideas I mentioned earlier. Looking at the other parts of the business gives me enough data to ask, how much capital are you going to put into these 4 new ideas, and what are their operating losses? If she can't give me good answers, I may have to say, look, we can't afford to do all 4 of these. You pick out 2 and we'll fund them, and then see if we can get to the other 2, depending on whatever. I don't want to finish reading the strategic plan, which calls for developing all 4 ideas, and then turn to the operating plan and have to say, oh my God, look at this. We can't do all 4 of these. She would say, well, we had all the ideas in the strategic plan, and you said you liked them. We put them in the operating plan. Now you come and you throw them out. When a business decides on new strategy, it needs to have a dialogue about the quality and aptitude of the people involved. At Honeywell, we decided to get into the electronics packaging business, that is, designing and developing chips for electronic motherboards. But we did not have people with the right technical background and manufacturing experience. We got into the business and lost money and never demonstrated that we had the right capabilities. We had an effective dialogue that recognized our capability shortfall, but we decided that we could overcome it. It turned out we couldn't. The person who had proposed the program had been very persuasive, and we hadn't had the courage to say no. We bet on the man and the organization, and in neither case was it enough to make share owners happy.
Throughout the processes outlined above, asking questions constantly keeps the critical issues in mind. Do you have the right leaders in the right jobs? How well do they work together? Do you have enough of the kind of people you need? Do you have the production, financial, and technological resources to execute the strategy? Following through. At the end of the strategy review, write a letter to each of the leaders to solidify and confirm the agreements you made so that later you can use them as the basis for reviewing progress. The letter should talk about growth and new products, and it should establish the link between strategy and people and operations. The following letter is typical of the letters that business unit leaders got at Allied Signal and that they get today at Honeywell. Date? June 22, 2000. To Jane Smith. From Larry Bossidy. Subject, X Systems Strategic Plan Review. This is a great business and a nice plan. Here are some specific comments. We must recognize that we are a target for our competitors. You should think about how we might attack ourselves if we were the competition. These are very competent companies, and we cannot become complacent. Remember, most firms whose substantial market position gets eroded are beaten either on cost or on technology. We must be prepared to compete on both. We should defend our current position in Europe. This region still appears to provide plenty of growth potential, and we do not want to create easy opportunities for competitors to gain a foothold here. We must identify the goals and vision of our customers. This will make it easier for us to plan for the future and will improve our ability to anticipate and meet customers' needs. Licensing our brands could be a nice program. We need to be careful how and where this is done to avoid adverse effects on our business. The relationship with customer A and the recovery at customer B are terrific. The B situation in Southern Europe was a big wake-up call, and it appears that you have responded well. Now we need to become more consistent in our customer service, especially if we expect to maintain a premium price. We obviously cannot fund all of the projects in this plan. You have to prioritize your opportunities and, for those further down the list, look for creative funding such as government programs. The wheel portfolio chart is a nice way to view our position. You should use it to track our progress. You should have a very receptive customer base for product Y. Customers D, E, and F all need to find ways to improve their performance in this segment, and this is one product that can help them. As we implement our aftermarket strategy, we must make sure that we are still meeting our customer needs. The small remanufacturing shops must deliver at least the level of service we currently provide. The K Group has done a nice job, although it is not clear that we can sustain our edge here. The Z business is on target. We must watch for new competition and keep an eye on our costs. We need a detailed and well-thought-out plan for our plants, one that considers the ZZ program as well as the current products. It is important to get this right the first time. We need distribution partners that add value for ZZ. We do not need brokers for our product. It is important to keep an eye on our competitors' systems capabilities and find the right partner to develop our own. You must continue to involve our lobbyist group to show congressional leaders the advantages of the product and dispel some of the current misconceptions. We need to improve our manufacturing capability before we offer new products. Although we have made improvements, our spare parts delivery rates are still unacceptable. We need to make Six Sigma translate into higher productivity. In the end, we are competing on cost, quality, and technology. We have to be in a position to win on cost. We should develop a progressive manufacturing strategy to keep our costs low. As we add to our current capacity, we should think about flexible capacity. We should be prepared for the eventual downturn in this market. Thailand makes sense, but I'm not sure about the Midwest. Before we establish sourcing and manufacturing in Asia, we should understand the effects of changes in the currency rates. We need to decide whether it would still make sense if the Asian currencies were to appreciate. We also must determine which components can be sourced locally and which can't. We must be confident that our core suppliers can meet our needs, both in quantity and quality. This is particularly important as we make our decision on location X. The BBB program is impressive. It should greatly improve our cycle time and engineering efficiency. The standard parts library will be a big opportunity for us. We have to be aggressive in patenting and defending our intellectual property. Look at competitor X closely to see if they are infringing on our patents. The CCC opportunity is nice, but still a ways away. Competitor Y has as much technology as anyone in this market. You should look to them for ideas. As we move to DDD technology, we should try to make it as simple as possible. We can still capture the majority of the value without adding all the potential complexity of these programs. Keep training high on the priority list. Make it as broad as you can. We must develop a diverse leadership team to match the global needs of this business. This is a good plan that will require a lot of work and leadership. This is a wonderful business with many opportunities. You need to set priorities for your growth projects to get the maximum returns on our investment. Finally, be sure to communicate your strategic thinking and programs to your entire organization. Their commitment and involvement will drive your success. In these chapters on strategy, and earlier in our discussion of the people process, we have laid out processes to determine where the leadership wants to take the business and who is going to get it there. We now move to the specifics on a short-term scale of 4 quarters. The outcome of this process, which we call operations, is a commitment. This process is where the moving parts in an organization are aligned. Chapter 9. The Operations Process. Making the Link with Strategy and People. Your boss has asked you to drive from Chicago to Oskaloosa, Iowa, a journey of 317 miles. He's prepared a budget for you with clear metrics. You can spend no more than $16 on gas. You must arrive in 5 hours and 37 minutes. And you can't drive over 60 miles per hour. But no one has a map with a route to Oskaloosa, and you don't know whether you'll run into a snowstorm on the way. Ludicrous? No more so than the way many companies translate their strategic plans into operations. They do it through a budgeting process that spells out the results you're supposed to achieve, such as revenues, cash flow, and earnings, and the resources you're allotted to achieve them. But the process doesn't deal with how or even whether you can get the results, so it is disconnected from reality. What you need is what you find in companies that execute, a robust operating process centered on an operating plan that links strategy and people to results. The strategy process defines where a business wants to go, and the people process defines who's going to get it there. The operating plan provides the path for those people. It breaks long-term output into short-term targets. Meeting those here and now targets forces decisions to be made and integrated across the organization, both initially and in response to changes in business conditions. It puts reality behind the numbers. The operating plan is not budgeting for "we did better than last year," Such budgeting looks into the rear-view mirror to set its goals. An operating plan looks forward to the hows. An operating plan includes the programs your business is going to complete within 1 year to reach the desired levels of such objectives as earnings, sales, margins, and cash flow. Among these programs are product launches, the marketing plan, a sales plan that takes advantage of market opportunities, a manufacturing plan that stipulates production outputs, and a productivity plan that improves efficiency. The assumptions on which the operating plan is based are linked to reality and are debated among the finance people and the line leaders who have to execute. For example, what effects will the growth or decline of the GDP and the level of interest rates and inflation have on the specific businesses covered by the plan? What happens if an important customer changes his plans in a big way? The operating plan specifies how the various moving parts of the business will be synchronized to achieve the targets, deals with trade-offs that need to be made, and looks at contingencies for the things that can go wrong or offer unexpected opportunities. We've made the point repeatedly that leaders have to be intimately involved in the three core processes and know the business, which they get in good measure from just that involvement. In the operating plan, the leader is primarily responsible for overseeing the seamless transition from strategy to operations. She has to set the goals, link the details of the operations process to the people and strategy processes, and lead the operating reviews that bring people together around the operating plan. She has to make timely, incisive judgments and trade-offs in the face of myriad possibilities and uncertainties. She has to conduct robust dialogue that surfaces truth, and she must, all the while, be teaching her people how to do these things as well. At the same time, the leader is learning about her people and how they behave when the rubber meets the road, and about the pitfalls that beset elegant strategies. It's not just the leader alone who has to be present and involved. All of the people accountable for executing the plan need to help construct it.
An operating plan is not about green eye shades putting numbers together. It's a total responsibility. It ties a thread through people, strategy, and operations, and it translates into assigning goals and objectives for the next year. You really want the operating plan to be owned by everybody. The more people you get involved in the plan, either through contingency plans or projects that have to be undertaken in the coming year, the more people who are aware of expectations for them, the more you achieve.
Such an operations process couldn't be more different from the typical budget struggle. We see three major flaws in the budgeting or operations process at most companies. First, the process doesn't provide for robust dialogue on the plan's assumptions. Second, the budget is built around the results that top management wants, but it doesn't discuss or specify the action programs that will make those outcomes a reality. Third, the process doesn't provide coaching opportunities for people to learn the totality of the business or develop the social architecture of working together in common cause. These operating plans are typically based on a budget that has been previously prepared. This is backward. The budget should be the financial expression of the operating plan and the underlying plans generated by the business's components, rather than the other way around. Budgets often have little to do with the reality of execution because they're numbers and gaming exercises, where people spend months figuring out how to protect their interests instead of focusing on the business's critical issues. The financial targets are often no more than the increases from the previous year's results that top management thinks security analysts expect. Down at the lower levels, people put out minimum bids for what they can do to beat those results. Often they'll sandbag, proposing numbers lower than those they think they can achieve. Then they'll negotiate with their bosses. Maybe they'll come up and the bosses will come down. Or maybe the bosses will say, no, these are our targets and you will meet them. No one necessarily knows how and why those numbers are reached, but they nonetheless become marching orders for the coming fiscal year. The process drains energy, diverting it into useless game playing. And the resulting rigid budget can lead to missed opportunities over the course of the year. Let's say that during the second quarter you've come up with a workable plan that could raise the market share of your business by 2 points before the year's end. Fulfilling the plan would take a small investment, but the likelihood of success is so great that it could put you over the top in terms of market share, and the payback will be less than 1 year. You present the plan to your boss and sit silently while he reads it. Finally, he looks at you sadly and says, "It's a great proposal, Bob, but there's no money in the budget for it." Such a budget can also force people to make poor decisions when they're desperate to reach their targets. One common practice, for example, is loading inventory into the pipeline just before the end of a quarter, often on overtime, to pump up the numbers. But the business will have to pay a price next quarter, when the managers will have to discount sharply or compromise manufacturing efficiency by cutting back production.
Most companies build their budgets or operating plans with a system designed by accounting people. The leaders set the goals using inspiring slogans like 15-5, 15% growth per annum over the next 5 years. Everybody goes around parroting it. The leaders say that half the growth will come organically, meaning from business that the organization already has, and half will come from acquisition. These aspirations show the leaders to be visionary. The CFO calculates that margins will improve, debt will be lowered, and the stock price will quadruple. But ask these leaders how they are going to achieve these goals, and what assumptions the goals are based on, and they will have no idea. We are going to work on that, they explain. Then each business unit does its planning compared with last year, and unconnected to the overall picture, with no common understanding or connection, and no simultaneous dialogue. This kind of budget process defeats the very purpose of planning. In the months between the time the budget preparations begin and final approval, some take as long as 4 months, the environment has probably changed. But the assumptions behind the budget remain. A static document in an active world, it reduces the organization's flexibility to respond to change. And it does nothing to help people synchronize the many moving parts of the organization. One CEO is wrestling with this problem now. His company has 5 businesses, and the stock price has been static for the past 5 years. 2 years ago, he came from another company, and he has done a good job of improving productivity. But growth has been much less than aspirations. Unless his performance improves, and the stock market rewards it with higher price-earning ratios, the company will have difficulty making many big acquisitions. The CEO has laid out a 5-year aspiration to inspire people to see what is possible. To flesh out his strategic plan, he has gotten his top 100 people together for 2 days to elicit ideas and get them fired up. He has now gotten each of his business units to think about new ways to create growth, new value propositions, new channels, new customers. He's changing beliefs, behaviors, people, and resource allocation. He's integrating horizontally by getting business units to sell together in the same channels. Now, he is creating an operating plan that has quarter-by-quarter action steps.
How to build a budget in 3 days. Most sizable businesses spend weeks or months preparing their budgets. This is unnecessary and a great waste of time. You probably recognize that it can and should be done much faster. But would you believe you can prepare your budget in 3 days? We know a number of companies that do it. The starting point is a robust dialogue among all the relevant business leaders who sit down together to understand the whole corporate picture, including all of the relationships among its parts. We call this the principle of simultaneity. Almost all budget or operating plan exercises are done sequentially, bottom up and top down. The goals and general assumptions come from the top, and the businesses generate the particulars. But sequential budgeting misses the power of simultaneous dialogue, which generates insights on the totality of the business and links its moving parts into a whole. The dialogue takes place in a 3-day session that includes all of the business unit leaders' direct reports, line, and staff. They've all previously been given the initial cut at the broad assumptions for the external environment, along with a set of competitor analyses and the financial and other targets for the year, quarter by quarter. The meeting focuses on the roughly 20 lines that, in just about any budget, account for 80% of the impact on the business outcomes. Among these, for example, are revenues by product mix, operating margins, marketing expenses, manufacturing costs, engineering and development expenses, and so forth. The leader starts by having each function present its action plans for meeting the proposed budget. He questions the assumptions to test their validity and asks how each action plan will affect the other businesses. For example, if a manager wants to cut her price to generate more volume, that will raise a yellow flag for manufacturing. What will the added costs be? Will it entail overtime? Other functions raise further questions. After everyone's had his or her say, the group breaks up for an hour, and each manager discusses the information with his sub-team. The manufacturing people, for example, will figure out how much they can cut costs given the higher volume, and therefore how much room there is to reduce prices. They'll talk about alternatives. Should they add a third shift or outsource? Where will they secure more components? When the groups reconvene, they all load their information into a common computer spreadsheet program. Within moments, they have a picture of what this budget would look like. They can see in real time what makes sense and what doesn't, and how well all of the components synchronize. Then they'll go through the process again, questioning, reshaping, and refining. Usually they're finished after 4 cycles. They've got their basic budget and operating plans. They'll fill the rest of the budget lines and flesh out the plans after they return to their offices. Don't bother to try this if you can't handle dialogue that reveals conflict or negotiate trade-offs persuasively, or if you're the kind of insecure individual who gets his power from hoarding information. But if you're up for it, this process will give you a reality-based budget that you can follow with confidence and adapt to changes in the business environment as they arise. Everyone will understand how they fit into the overall business. You'll find that people will be able to move faster and will be more willing to experiment with good ideas, knowing they aren't trapped in a rigid and probably obsolete budget structure. You'll also find it's a powerful team-building exercise. The importance of synchronization. Synchronization is essential for excellence in execution and for energizing the corporation. Synchronization means that all the moving parts of the organization have common assumptions about the external environment over the operating year and a common understanding. The left hand knows what the right hand is doing. Synchronizing includes matching the goals of the interdependent parts and linking their priorities with other parts of the organization. When conditions change, synchronization realigns the multiple priorities and reallocates resources. For example, take an automobile company with 10 brands and some 3 million combinations of options and colors, more than 100 plants around the globe, hundreds of suppliers, thousands of dealers, and 6 ad agencies. Each of these components makes decisions every day, and they are in motion, always changing. When interest rates go down, not all market segments grow equally, not all brands are required to expand output equally, and not all dealers will sell equally more cars. So they have to be synchronized to take advantage of the differential market segments by geography, dealer, and the like. In a large company, it's a complex task. For example, when somebody decides to promote a new item, they need 6 months lead time to order it. The moving parts are advertising, promotion, stocking the shelves, and logistics, which is often outsourced. If something outside changes, the relationships have to change. For example, if demand declines, the relationships among advertising, promotion, planning for production, and inventory levels have to change. But change how? What becomes more important and less important? Operating systems in companies that execute well, such as GE, Walmart, Dell, and Colgate-Palmolive, synchronize these things faster and better than others. September 11th created real concern in Detroit that demand for vehicles would tank. And it did indeed disappear for a few days. Ron Zarella, General Motors Vice President for North America, conceived of 0% financing, and implementing it put demand in high gear. Never was there a better time for it. In November, the Federal Reserve continued to reduce interest rates to a 40-year low of 1.75%. Consumers were able to refinance and gain cash for down payments. Demand shot from a rate of 16 million units annually to 21 million plus. The move required an operating plan to reprogram and reallocate resources and to synchronize GM's various moving parts. How many of which kinds of vehicles should GM build? In which plants? Which regions would require what mix of products? How much advertising money should the company spend and where and on which products? If production and advertising did not balance, the result would be a double negative. With margins cut by the 0% financing, an imbalance between production and advertising would both lose sales and raise costs. This program opened up a big opportunity for GM. Though other automakers joined quickly, GM's swift execution gave the company an immediate boost in market share. And GM went all out with it. Because it felt the program could be not just a one-shot measure, but a chance to reverse its three-decade decline in market share. Cost-cutting had begun to improve the company's productivity. Vice Chairman Bob Lutz, the celebrated car guy who led Chrysler's hot product streak, was already making decisions that would show up in the current year's advertising and in next year's vehicles. GM's premise was that the marketplace momentum and higher morale generated by the program would help it hang on to the gains and even increase them. Sound assumptions, the key to setting realistic goals. An operating plan addresses the critical issues in execution by building the budget on realities. What do the capital markets expect, and what are your assumptions about the business environment? If it's sunshine, how do you take advantage of the opportunities better than your competitors? If it's rain, what actions do you need to perform to ride out the storm better than them? How well do your business leaders understand this, and how imaginative are they in capitalizing on the changes? How good are they at robust dialogue, with which they can grasp reality and act without needing to wait for the approval of higher-level people? Debate on assumptions is one of the most critical parts of any operating review. Not just the big-picture assumptions, but assumptions specifically linked with their effects on the business, segment by segment, item by item. That's a key part of what's missing in the standard budget review. You cannot set realistic goals until you've debated the assumptions behind them. In budget and operating plan negotiations, there's an inherent conflict of interests. People bring assumptions to the negotiations through the lenses of their functions and their positions. For example, a production man wants to have the lowest possible costs, so he wants to build the maximum amount of product and have a stable production level. The sales leader likes the idea of having lots of product, too. The more she has on the shelf, the better chance she has of making a sale. And why shouldn't they press for their assumptions? Both of their incentives are linked to their specific functional achievements. The finance officer, on the other hand, is saying, "Wait a minute. I don't see this kind of growth in the economy. We'll wind up with a ton of inventory, which will cut into our cash. Then we'll have to discount it and spend a lot of extra promotion money to get rid of it." In the standard budget review, they'll all negotiate from their assumptions and reach some sort of compromise. But what you really want to do is get all of the assumptions out in the open, with everyone present and a leader who asks penetrating questions. Then you want to test those assumptions by going to customers or some other source to be sure they're valid. With this kind of information, the group can make intelligent trade-offs based on reality. That's what you do in an operating review. Debating the assumptions and making trade-offs openly in a group is an important part of the social software. It builds the business leadership capacities of all the people involved. As they construct and share a common comprehensive picture of what's happening on the outside and the inside, they hone their ability to synchronize efforts for execution. And they publicly make their commitments to execute.
You have to debate the underlying assumptions before you even begin to think about a financial expression of numbers. As a leader, you question all the way down the line whether people have thought through all the ingredients in the plan. You need to be able to identify any assumptions that might be troublesome in case they don't spot them. You're not saying in the back of your mind, "There's no way these guys are going to make this plan," so as to later smile and say, "I told you so." You want to do all you can to help them make the plan. For example, if I saw a fourth quarter sales spike in somebody's plan, I'd say, "Why? What's going to happen in the fourth quarter that's going to cause this?" I don't want you to go into the plan with an unrealistic challenge. I want it to be ambitious. I want it to be a little bit of a stretch, but I want it to be achievable. You need a range of assumptions, some negative and a couple positive. For example, suppose you've got labor negotiations coming up in your business. If they go badly, you may need a plan to build inventories in case of a strike. Or what do you do if your research budget, for reasons that you can't anticipate now, overruns by $5 million? From what other parts of the business are you going to get the $5 million? Or, on the upside, what will happen if your sales double? How do you get your manufacturing organization aligned so that it can produce that kind of volume? What do you do if you run into shortage of parts that require long lead times? You don't want to hold these debates too soon, by the way. It's important to make an operating plan as timely as you can. People often put numbers together way too early. I like to see the thinking start in August, but not the detailed numbers. Start with some ideas about what the sales and earnings of each component will be. You can't develop the ideas and the numbers independently of each other. But keep in mind that these numbers will be at 10,000 feet. The plan shouldn't get granulated, exposed in detail, until all the thinking about the components is completed. We finalize our plan in November.
What kinds of assumptions are we talking about? They cover the lot. Anything that can affect your business requires some kind of assumption. First and foremost, who is the customer? How does he buy it? And why? What's the need? How long will the need last? What is the competition doing? Is your value proposition good enough? And if you're an industrial business, who is the customer's customer, or even the customer's customer's customer? His demands or problems are going to affect your customer. Many people look myopically at their primary customers and don't pay enough attention to the customers who ultimately determine demand for their products.
After the telecommunications bubble burst, Cisco Systems was slow to face reality. When the company finally changed course, most of its suppliers were stuck with the huge amounts of inventory that they have been building, based on companies' unwanted optimism. Not so with a small Portland, Oregon supplier. Well before Cisco finally announced its cutbacks, this CEO had asked his board members what they knew about